Papua New Guinea is one of the last untouched places where an observer might at least have a chance of finding out what life was like in the region hundreds of years ago. It's a way of life that needs protecting, though, the modern world being what it is. And if the area runs out of its limited resources, much will be lost. Scientists from the Bishop Museum have been traveling to Papua since the 1960s. Ken Longnecker is one of them, and he's with us in CR7 this morning. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning.
What do you find when you go down there?
Well, we find a place that's much like Hawaii at about the time of Western contact, we think. It's a very remote location that we go to. We're in a small subsistence village. People live a traditional sort of lifestyle. Most people get most of their life's needs from the surrounding environment. And one of the most interesting things about this village that we've been working with is they didn't even have a writing system for their language until just 2 years ago.
Wow. That tells you quite a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah.
My gosh. Well, how was their stories and legends were preserved, right? Were they done in the same way as the Hawaiians through an oral tradition?
There's oral tradition. Fortunately, a group of anthropologists and linguists have been down there working with them very recently and working to preserve some of the local legends, including history of the village and the village during World War II. There's a lot of stories related to that as well.
So, oh, I would imagine.
So those are being recorded now as a project from some of our colleagues at the University of British Columbia.
Were there things like jungle airstrips built in the region?
Yes, I think there was quite a large beachhead established by the Japanese at one point in time, and then the Americans had moved in there. So the last time I was down there, I was hearing stories about when the Japanese were in the village.
Yeah, because in World War II, this area of the world that really hadn't had anybody come near it suddenly took on enormous geographical strategic importance,
yes, it
didn't
did.
It?
Yes.
Well, this community that you lived in, Kamiali. Kamiali,
yes.
Sorry. Is it on the ocean?
It is on the ocean. It's about 40 miles down the coast from a port town called Lae, which was a major American airstrip during the war. So it's somewhat close to an urban center. However, it's far enough away that you're not touched by a lot of urban life and a lot of urban problems that would exist in that part of the country.
So the subsistence is what? Lots of fish from the ocean? What else?
Fish is the major source of dietary protein for these people. Also, they will go out and get shellfish and things like that. But I think if you really analyze their diet, the majority of protein comes from fish. And then there would be garden that would be the gardening would be the plant-based portion of their diets.
So what are the threats to the stability, the sustainability, if you will, of their society?
Threats to sustainability, I would say that there's movements towards urbanization everywhere in the world, and these people oftentimes see the same sorts of things that we have and might be wanting those too.
Mm-hmm.
They would need sources of cash. One of the interesting things about this village is because it's subsistence economy pretty much, they really don't have too much cash, but they're always looking for sources of cash. And other villages along this region of Papua New Guinea, this is along the Huon coast, have turned to selling logging and mining rights.
Oh boy.
In their territories, and these have often had disastrous environmental and oftentimes social consequences. And the folks at the village that we've been working with took a look at that and said, hey, this is really not something that we want for ourselves or future generations, so we're going to try to preserve a traditional lifestyle.
So they came to understand that once you give up on a resource like that, it's never going to be recovered, right?
That's right. Oftentimes, too, the other side of this is they're very much proud of, I think, of their culture, and they want to try to preserve their traditional lifestyle as well. And sometimes when loggers or miners come in there, they tend to be outside workers, and there would be problems associated with those individuals coming in, perhaps some violence and drug use and drinking and things like that. And it's just something that they don't want for themselves.
So when you're talking about kind of the poisons that modern life brings with it, you're talking about things like drugs and crime and the things that happen when you get into a cash economy from a tribal economy.
Right, right.
So how can you folks help at the Bishop Museum?
Well, we've been going down for a while, and one of the really interesting things about this place is I didn't tell you about the size of the population down there. There's about 600 people that live in this village, and they control a territory that includes about 180 square miles of rainforest and ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's only 600 people living there, that whole territory is in a relatively pristine condition. And my colleague at the Bishop Museum, Alan Allison, took a look and said, hey, you can really use this relatively pristine environment as a income-generating model. And what we do is go down and say, hey, you've got this really good-looking area. A lot of biologists would be very interested in coming down and studying a near-pristine ecosystem.
Because the wildlife has got to be incredible.
It is incredible, and that's what we hope and has actually been very good at drawing people down there. So when the scientists arrive, they're paying for room and board, they're hiring local field assistants, they're hiring boats and boat drivers, paying modest research fees. So what this does is provide an income stream to the village. And then the village recognizes that the success of this whole venture depends on them continuing to maintain their natural environment in a relatively pristine state. So they have motivation to continue this environmental conservation. So this whole thing is intended to be a self-sustaining cycle, but importantly, producing income for the village, providing for those cash needs, such as for medicine and education for the kids.
But it is a very delicate dance, isn't it, introducing an income stream that isn't somehow a polluting income stream.
It is a delicate dance, and oftentimes in the past, there'd be big conservation projects that would go on. They would be funded, and when the funding dries up for those projects, the conservation project goes away as well.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this one, the intention is that it's self-sustaining because the more they conserve the environment, the more likely more scientists are going to be to come down there and take a look around.
And it sounds as if it is the whole project is skewed toward an appreciation of what went before.
Yes, yes.
What went before you guys showed up.
Right? Yes, and trying to be very respectful of their culture.
Yeah.
And actually, we go down and learn quite a bit from them.
I would imagine.
Like I said, this place seems to be what Hawaii might have been like at around the time of Western contact. So I think there's even lessons for us here.
I can only imagine. Thanks very much for coming and being on the show, Ken.
You bet. Thank you.
Great to have you. Ken Longnecker has worked with the Bishop Museum at its Kamiali Field Station in Papua New Guinea, and you can find photos of his work on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.